Hello, you're listening to The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. Episode 3, Cast of Characters. Здравствуйте, товарищи. Hello, comrades, and welcome back. As you can tell from the length of this episode, after two back-to-back theory-heavy and long episodes, today we're keeping it relatively simple. Our goal today is to introduce some of the big players we will encounter in the Russian Revolution portion of our narrative. We won't be going through an exhaustive list of all the parties or a complete breakdown of their ideologies, because that would end up being probably the longest episode of the entire series, and, well, we need a break. Instead, we're going to focus on five main players: the Tsar, the Cadets, the Socialist Revolutionaries, the Mensheviks, and the Bolsheviks. We'll discuss the most salient points of each, as well as some of the big names that will come up as we go forward. Without further ado, let's get into it. The Tsars as a political institution stretched back nearly 400 years in Russian history, and for that entire time, they had acted as absolute monarchs. From the first Tsar, Ivan the Terrible, to Peter the Great, Catherine the Great, and straight through to our man in the Russian Revolution, Nikolai II, the Tsars of Russia wielded an authority that was more complete than almost anywhere else on Earth. Of course, even when you are sitting that high up on the pyramid, you don't wield truly absolute authority. Being Tsar, King, or Emperor always requires skill. Skill at governing, skill at diplomacy, skill at balancing the different and sometimes competing interests around you. Some of the Tsars, Peter III and Pavel I, for example, were not skilled enough to avoid being overthrown and killed. But Nikolai II, well, he takes the pierogi when talking about rulers lacking the necessary skill to rule. When the Wheel of Fortune finally landed on Nikolai and he became Tsar, he felt the weight of his ancestors on his shoulders. He was hyper-aware of the legacy of absolute monarchy that he now continued. And throughout his entire reign, up to the very end, he never really wanted to share power with anyone. He feared it would be a betrayal of everything his forebears had worked so hard to preserve and pass down to him. A betrayal of Russia itself. The problem was, he didn't really seem interested in exercising his power, either. To be honest, in his personal life, Nikolai was not necessarily a bad man. He was, in fact, a tender family man, deeply in love with his wife, Alexandra, and their children. He was particularly concerned about his son and heir to the throne, the Tsarevich Alexei, because he suffered from hemophilia, a disease that was not only a constant source of personal anxiety for Nikolai and Alexandra as parents, but also posed a potential national security threat should something happen to him and the heir be incapacitated, or, God forbid, die. So the real tragedy of Nikolai's life, at least from his perspective, was that he was the Tsar, a job to which, by almost every metric imaginable, he was horribly suited, and one which he never really wanted. Had he been allowed to simply attend to his family, who knows, he probably would have been happy. But that's just not how things went for him. But I don't want to create the impression that we should all feel sorry for little Nikolai Romanov. Just because he never wanted the responsibilities that befell him does not mean he did not have them. And while he was, like all of us, a flawed individual with plenty of character defects, the one defect that had the gravest consequences for the people of Russia was his indecision. Nikolai hated making executive decisions, which is definitely a big problem if you are the executive for an entire empire. His indecision manifested as being wishy-washy, changing his mind constantly and lacking the conviction necessary to stay a course once embarked on. This all painted him as apathetic to the outcomes of his actions and decisions, which only served to alienate the Tsar from everyone around him. Had Nikolai possessed simply an awkward affect, which made him only appear indecisive and apathetic, but this was countered by a competent and capable management of the affairs of empire, things would likely have been fine. But his indecision was no affect, and it led Nikolai to make a multitude of mistakes during his reign, which, by the end, demonstrated to everyone, noble, soldier, worker, and peasant, that in order for Russia to survive, the Tsar had to go. We will go over these poor decisions in more detail next time. For now, it is enough to know that if ever there was the wrong man for a job, it was Nikolai for the job of Tsar. Next up, we have the liberal political party, the Cadets. The Kadetsy were the nickname given to the Konstitutsionni Demokrati, or Constitutional Democrats. In Russian, constitutional spelled with a K, so their initials were the Cyrillic letters K and D, hence the Kadetsy, or in English, the Cadets. As I said, this party represented the Russian liberals, insofar as there were any Russian liberals to speak of. The liberal tradition in the Russian Empire went back over 100 years before 1917. It had started when Catherine the Great, at the end of the 18th century, had become enamored with the Enlightenment and attempted to incorporate some of the ideas of the French liberal movement. She ultimately abandoned the project right around the time the French king's head abandoned his body, but a portion of the nobility never gave up the dream of achieving a constitutional monarchy in Russia. They had tried forcing the issue once during the famous Decembrist Revolt of 1825, but it had been very poorly planned and so failed, and the leaders were executed by Nikolai I. After that, the liberals found that Nikolai I, possibly the most autocratic of the autocrats in Russian history, had absolutely no patience for their aspirations. And while there was a handful of prominent liberal nobles and political writers in Nikolai's reign, in the atmosphere of Russian Tsarist autocracy, they never really were able to do anything but opine for a constitutional monarchy. The liberals as a group included some of the noble aristocracy, as well as the educated professionals, known as the intelligentsia, and upper classes who were just well off enough and considered themselves capable enough to feel like they should have a say in how the empire was run, but were not actually part of the ruling minority, and so were institutionally and legally barred from having any input. The liberals finally got their wish, being able to maybe have some political power of their own, when, in 1905, Tsar Nikolai II agreed to a constitutional monarchy. But like I said just a bit ago, the Tsar never really wanted to share his authority. Without any actual means of influencing the politics of the empire, on the eve of the February Revolution, they were basically a loyal opposition. When suddenly the Tsar was removed from the picture, the liberals believed it was finally their time to shine, but, spoiler alert, they were wrong. They really will have absolutely nothing to do with the Soviet Union as a whole, and for that simple reason, there's not much more to say about them, except that the two biggest cadets we will meet are Prince Georgi Yevgenievich Lvov, who will serve as Prime Minister after the February Revolution until July, and Pavel Nikolaevich Miliukov, a member of the intelligentsia from Moscow who is one of the founders of the Cadet Party and served as Minister of Foreign Affairs after February until the end of April. Moving on, while there were a handful of other smaller political parties, mostly right and center-right, the political landscape of the Russian revolutions of 1917 was dominated by parties that openly described themselves as socialists. If the cadets could maybe claim to represent at least a part of the nobility itself constituted only about 5% of the overall population in Russia at the time. The rest were peasants, the vast majority, 85%, and workers, roughly 10%. The peasants were represented, theoretically at least, by the Socialisti Revolutionari, or Socialist Revolutionaries. They were more commonly known by their nickname, which was again derived from their initials, the SRs. The SRs are, in my opinion, one of the more fascinating political parties of the Russian Revolution, if only because they could lay claim to one of the oldest revolutionary traditions in Russia at the time, yet refuse to learn from that tradition's failures. The SRs were the ideological heirs of the Narodniki, or the populists, which was a social movement from the 1860s and 70s. At that time, large sections of the intelligentsia believed the existence of the Tsar, of absolute monarchy in Russia was the main barrier to progress in the empire. Eventually, a small subsection became convinced that the removal of the Tsar altogether would result in the emancipation of the people. The thing was, the people were overwhelmingly peasants, and the populace believed the peasants as a group were too enamored with their so-called Father Tsar. They were too convinced that the Father Tsar was their protector, not their oppressor. The populace thought the peasants were too ignorant of the true nature of the Tsarist oppression, and needed to be shaken out of their stupor. Once they were, the theory went, they would mobilize to overthrow the Tsar, and, well, actually, they never really thought out much more beyond that. These populist ideas eventually led, in the 1870s, to the Khazdinya v Narod, or Go to the People campaign. This was where young intelligentsia and students visited the countryside across the empire, with the goal of agitating against the Tsar and inspiring spontaneous uprisings by telling the peasants the truth about the Tsar, at least as they saw it. It should come as no surprise that the campaign was a huge flop. Most agitators were reported to the authorities by the peasants themselves and were arrested or driven out of town. The campaign failed specifically because the populists made absolutely no efforts to connect with the peasantry, to learn from them, to meet them where they were, learn about their grievances, how they lived, what their problems were, what they enjoyed about their lives. Populists would too often show up in a village square and simply start denouncing the Tsar out of the blue. They would just start yelling, "The Tsar is your oppressor! Don't just stand there, you need to rebel! The Tsar must go, now!" But to the peasants, these populists were as alien as actual foreigners. Their dress and mannerisms were too urban, their language was too arrogant, their accents hard to understand, and their words sounded absolutely insane. Without any proper organizing among the peasantry, the entire venture was a bust from the start. As the saying goes, they went to the people, but the people sent them back. After that failed campaign, the populist movement morphed and adopted new tactics gleaned from what were, sadly, the exact wrong lessons to take away. Instead of recognizing that they needed to work to bridge the gap between the urban elites and the rural masses, they decided political terrorism and assassination was the new way to wake the peasants from their stupor. And so they embarked on a campaign to assassinate as many officials in the Tsarist bureaucracy as possible, including the Tsar himself. The Tsar in question was Alexander II, and he became the target of 6 separate attempts on his life. The sad irony of this was, however, that as far as absolute monarchs go, Alexander II was probably the best one Russia ever had, probably even one of the best in modern world history. He was by far the most liberal Tsar in the nation's history. He was known as the Tsar Liberator for having abolished serfdom in 1861, a full 2 years before slavery in the U.S. was abolished, and even then, not entirely. He also set up one of the most advanced and progressive judiciaries in all of Europe at the time, and would it shock you to hear that, by the time of his death in 1881, he had started taking actual steps towards setting up the constitutional monarchy the liberals were pining for? This is not to say that absolute monarchy as a system of governance is a good idea, only that Alexander was a model, enlightened monarch, which is the absolute best kind of monarch that system can produce. Which is why I do think it was a tragedy when Alexander was eventually assassinated on the 1st of March, 1881, when a member of a terrorist group, Narodnaya Volya, or the People's Will, threw a bomb at his carriage. Alexander was literally blown in half, with his legs missing and his torso ripped open. He survived the blast, only to be carried to the Winter Palace, where he died in the same room he had signed the Emancipation Proclamation for the serfs, almost exactly 20 years to the day prior. Yet again, however, the revolutionaries had miscalculated. The assassination of the Tsar did not result in a revolutionary wave from below, but a reactionary one from above. Alexander III, the new Tsar and son of the Tsar Liberator, had been present for his father's last moments, had witnessed the bloody heap that had been his dad draw its final breaths, and the lessons he drew from that day were crystal clear. His father had tried for nearly 30 years to turn the Russian Empire into a modern, progressive nation, and for his trouble, he had been blown to smithereens. The new Tsar vowed that would not happen to him, and so unleashed new waves of secret police and political repression to root out any further attempts at political terrorism across the empire. One of those rooted-out attempts, you will remember, involved Vladimir Lenin's brother, Alexander Ulyanov. This brings us back now to the SRs. In the face of this new repression, the populists as a group were pretty much over with. But the new SR party grew out of the remains of the populist and terrorist movements of the late 19th century, and was founded in 1901 as the Agrarian Socialist Party in Russia. As the, quote, party of the peasants, they attempted to incorporate some of Marx's analysis, such as the roles of classes in society and the inner workings and contradictions of capitalism. However, as we know by now, Marx's analysis wasn't really a good fit for the peasant class, and so the SRs became this odd duck among the Russian left. They claimed to agree with Marx's analyses, however, by still holding the peasantry as the key to a successful revolution against autocracy in Russia, they disavowed Marx's conclusions, leaving their overall ideology rather muddled. What's even more interesting is that the party never truly abandoned its terrorist roots, continuing into even the 1910s. I think it was this failure to learn the lessons of their past, the need to actually organize the class they represented, and the futility of political terrorism even when it completely backfired on them after blowing up Alexander II, that explains more than anything their ultimate inability to present a serious alternative to the Bolsheviks in 1917. Well, that and the fact that they weren't actually serious about the revolution after all, but we'll get there. In terms of big names for this party, there are a few we will come across in the coming episodes. But if we were to pick out the one to know, there is absolutely no doubt that it is Alexander Fyodorovich Kerensky. Kerensky served in various capacities in the provisional government between February and October, including Minister of Justice, of War, and Prime Minister. He is simultaneously both a fascinating historical figure and an absolute bore of a man. Fascinating because he is right there in the thick of the entire year of 1917. However, his legacy is that he played an enormous, almost decisive role in almost all of the missteps the provisional government will make. The June Offensive, which is sometimes called the Kerensky Offensive since he was at the time Minister of War. His ascendancy to the office of Prime Minister after the July days. His absolutely bizarre and nearly catastrophic flirtation with military dictatorship at the end of August. And then, finally, his foolish and ignorant political maneuvering in September and October that will finally drive a critical mass of people across the country into the Bolshevik Party. In many ways, he was the Nikolai of the provisional government, an individual who somehow found himself at the center of absolutely critical world historical events, but was unequivocally not up to the tasks. And so he just kind of blindly groped his way through them until, very suddenly, he was no longer at the center, but on the outside looking in. But I myself think he's paradoxically a boring individual. Kerensky just kind of wound up where he did. He was not a particularly adept politician or firebrand speaker in the SR party. Hell, he was barely even a member of the SRs. He just kind of said he was affiliated with them, and the SRs never denied it. Now, to be fair to Kerensky, sure, before the revolution, he'd made a name for himself as an attorney for revolutionaries, defending them in court from Tsarist prosecution. And his public speaking, while not as electrifying as Trotsky's, was certainly eloquent enough. But after the February Revolution, he does not command any great respect from the parties or the politicians. He does not distinguish himself as a master politician or negotiator. He straddles both the Petrograd Soviet and the provisional government, acting as a bridge between the two bodies while enacting a dampening influence on the more radical elements of the Soviet on behalf of the provisional government. But now I'm just getting ahead of myself. The main thing to know here is that Alexander Kerensky will be there for the entirety of the Russian Revolution of 1917, playing a pivotal role at many crucial junctures. But in the end, he will be remembered either as one of the most disgraceful, ineffective, and hated politicians of his time, or the dunce who wound up losing the revolution to Lenin. Actually, come to think of it, it's probably both. This leaves us with just one more party to introduce, but really, it is two more parties. So we are going to take a quick break, and then we will be back to talk all about the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party. If you are enjoying this show, and if you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. As I am just starting out, I do not yet have Patreon-exclusive material. However, if the Patreon page attracts enough attention, that will definitely change. Please also leave a review and rating on whichever podcast platform you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. Now, back to the show. The Russian Social Democratic Labor Party, or RSDLP, was founded in 1898 as the expressly Marxist party in Russia, although it was not the first group of Marxists to ever exist in the empire. The party came from humble beginnings. At that first founding Congress, only 9 delegates were present. As mentioned in the last episode, Lenin was one of the original members of the party, and we will introduce a handful of other very important names toward the end of today. But for now, we're going to focus on the Second Congress of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party, which took place in 1903 in first Brussels, then, after the Belgian police chased the delegation out, concluded in London. For it is at this Congress that the split which would come to define the Russian Revolution occurred. At this Congress, there were 51 delegates present. There was much theoretical and political maneuvering throughout the event, but the only maneuver of importance to us here is the question of defining a member of the party, because it was out of this seemingly trivial matter that two rival factions were born. At the 22nd session of the Congress, Lenin argued for a definition of a party member as one, quote, who recognizes its program and supports the party both by material means and by personal participation in one of the party organizations, end quote. Another member, Julius Martov, argued that a party member could be anyone, quote, who accepts its program, supports the party by material means, and who renders it regular personal assistance under the direction of one of its organizations, end quote. At first glance, these different definitions of a party member appear to be a minor point, over which it could hardly be worth cleaving the young party in twain. But to Lenin, the difference between personal participation in one of the party organizations and regular personal assistance under the direction of one of its organizations was the crux of the entire thing. Regular personal assistance was too vague and lax a definition. Coupled with under the direction of a party organization, all that really meant was, as long as one person attended meetings and showed up sometimes to help pass out flyers or march in the streets, they could be considered a member of the party. But personal participation was direct. It wasn't vague. It meant going to the meetings, but then also attending additional meetings for whatever your organization was. It meant voting on decisions and strategies. It meant showing up in the streets when needed, but in a much more militant capacity. In short, by requiring direct participation, Lenin was forging a core of dedicated professional revolutionaries, the vanguard party he had argued for in What Is to Be Done just the year before. Requiring all members of the party to participate directly in the party's activities and committees would, Lenin believed, ensure commitment and prevent casual hangers-on from joining the party. Martov's definition, by contrast, allowed only loose affiliation with the party, which Lenin was certain would lead to the dilution of the party's impact, and the opportunism we discussed last time against which Lenin was ever vigilant. Even if Martov's definition might lead to a party with bigger numbers on paper, it would not count for much if those numbers were wishy-washy and not particularly dedicated. In other words, Lenin was fine with a smaller party if it meant the members were a more disciplined and effective force. He wanted quality over quantity. In a stroke of irony which will become clear in a moment, on the vote on the issue of membership, the issue which split the party, Lenin's faction lost. Martov's definition carried the day 28-23. However, a few days later, some of the members who voted with Martov, the 5 Jewish Bundists and the 2 economist delegates, exited the conference due to differences on completely separate issues. Martov's faction therefore wound up with 7 fewer votes the remainder of the Congress, while Lenin's faction maintained its 23 votes and therefore held the majority. Lenin's majority then won 2 of the 3 seats on the editorial board of the party's newspaper, Iskra, or The Spark, and the 3 spots on the central committee of the party were all occupied by Leninists as well. It is from the final tally of holding majorities on the central committee and the editorial board of the party newspaper that we get the names Bolsheviki and Mensheviki, or Bolsheviks and Mensheviks. Bolsheviks translates roughly into English as the majoritarians, while Mensheviks translates roughly into the minoritarians. Lenin created the labels as a piece of propaganda to elevate his own faction over Martov's, which is why it is ironic that the Bolsheviks actually lost the vote that led to their faction being created in the first place. But the supreme irony of this is that, until the events of 1917, the Bolsheviks were actually consistently the minority faction in the RSDLP. There were attempts at reconciliation between the two factions over the next 14 years, and they even came close once or twice, but they never formally reunited. The rift eventually became permanent, and the two factions had separated into their own full-blown parties by 1917. As we'll see when we get to the events of that year, the Mensheviks ultimately did wind up succumbing to opportunism, exactly as Lenin had predicted. The reason for this is twofold. First, as we've discussed, there was the issue of membership, which left the party wide open to all sorts of influences. But the second, and perhaps more important, reason had its roots in an understanding of Marx's historical materialism. You'll recall from the episode on Marxism that, according to Marx, history was driven by the material realities of human existence, and that Marx conceptualized history as proceeding in stages. There was primitive communism, slavery, feudalism, capitalism, socialism, and then finally, advanced communism. In the early 20th century, these stages were taken as almost axiomatic. In the Russian context, this meant that most socialists believed that Russia had yet to have its bourgeois revolution, such as had occurred in England, France, and the United States. Russia had been trapped in feudalism for far too long, and only with the abolition of serfdom in 1861, about which we'll have much more to say next time, could one say that Russia was finally in the process of moving out of feudalism and fully into capitalism. The development of capitalism is another topic for next time. But here and now, the point to take away is that the Mensheviks, for the most part, will stubbornly adhere to the belief that without a prolonged period of bourgeois rule in Russia, it was, at best, unwise to attempt a socialist revolution, and at worst, disastrous. Now, to be fair, there were plenty of Bolsheviks who also held this belief prior to 1917. But whereas the Mensheviks never abandoned it, the Bolsheviks over the course of 1917 came to believe that an immediate socialist revolution was not only possible, it was necessary. The Mensheviks, meanwhile, would become the true social democratic party of the Russian Revolution. The problem was that, by then, social democracy as a school of leftist thought had proven itself completely devoid of any real revolutionary ideology, and had instead morphed into a quasi-socialist tendency, more concerned with reconciliation and collaboration with capitalism than with overthrowing it. To close us out today, I want to introduce very, very briefly four other prominent Bolsheviks who, along with Lenin, will be with us for a long time to come. It's time to say hello to Kamenev, Zinoviev, Trotsky, and Stalin. Lev Borisovich Rosenfeld, known to history by the pseudonym Kamenev, meaning of stone, was born the 6th of July, 1883, in Moscow, the son of a railway worker. Both of his parents were involved in radical politics. His father, Boris, had actually been a classmate of the man who had blown up Tsar Alexander II. Kamenev joined the RSDLP in 1901, and at the 1903 Congress, he sided with his colleague and friend Lenin, and so was one of the so-called Old Bolsheviks. Kamenev was initially a close ally of Lenin's, although we will see later on that there were several key moments when Kamenev broke with Lenin and their bond weakened as a result. Grigory Yevseyevich Zinoviev was born the 11th of September, 1883, in Yelizavetgrad, Ukraine, which is present-day Kropivnitsky, north of Odessa. He also joined the RSDLP in 1901 and, like Kamenev, was initially a close ally of Lenin's and an old Bolshevik. From 1903 to 1917, Zinoviev was practically Lenin's right-hand man, living at various times in Russia and abroad. But also like Kamenev, Zinoviev broke with Lenin at crucial moments during the Revolution of 1917, and his bond with Lenin was weakened as well. Lev Davidovich Bronstein, known to history by the pseudonym Trotsky, was born the 25th of October, 1879, in Yanovka, which is present-day Berislavka in south-central Ukraine. He began his revolutionary career actually as a Narodnik, but almost immediately was converted to Marxism. In 1898, he was arrested as a union organizer and spent 2 years awaiting trial, being shuffled between prisons in Ukraine and Moscow. It was in prison that he read for the first time one of Lenin's early works, The Development of Capitalism in Russia, and when he learned of the founding congress of the RSDLP, he considered himself a member of the party, even from prison. In 1900, Trotsky was exiled to Siberia. While there, he married his first wife, Alexandra Sokolovskaya, with whom he had two daughters, Zinaida and Nina. He managed to escape exile in 1902 and fled abroad, where he met Lenin for the first time. Trotsky was present at the 1903 Congress and initially sided with Martov, but by 1904 he declared himself neutral in the split. He only officially joined the Bolsheviks in 1917, in the wake of the February Revolution, but once he did, he became a leading ideological figure in the Bolshevik Party, and later one of the most important figures in the early years of the Soviet Union. Trotsky was also a prolific writer and left behind a large body of work, including diaries, an autobiography, a history of the Russian Revolution in 3 volumes, and numerous pamphlets and shorter works arguing his positions and chronicling Russian and Soviet history. Oh, also, fun fact, his sister, Olga, was Lev Kamenev's wife. Just throwing that out there. And that leaves us with just one more name to introduce. Yosef Vissarionovich Djugashvili, known to history as Stalin, meaning Man of Steel, was born in Gori, Georgia, on the 6th of December, 1878. His father was a shoemaker, and his mother was a house cleaner. However, his father Vissarion's business eventually went bust, and he started drinking heavily and becoming abusive toward his family. His mother, Yekaterin, eventually took her son with her when she left her husband. When he was a young man, he moved to Tiflis, present-day Tbilisi, to join a seminary and become a priest. While there, he ended up reading Marx and losing interest in his seminary studies. Eventually, he left the seminary altogether to become a revolutionary. He joined the RSDLP in 1898 and worked hard to cultivate the Georgian branch as a serious agitator and organizer among Georgian workers. He helped organize and participated in numerous marches, demonstrations, and strikes, which earned him the attention of the Tsarist and local police. In fact, of the four individuals named here, Stalin was the only one not at the 1903 Congress, because he had been arrested and exiled to Siberia. However, once he escaped and returned to Tiflis, he declared himself a Bolshevik and proved himself a stalwart opponent of the Mensheviks in Georgia. With these brief early bios, we have Lenin, Trotsky, Stalin, Kamenev, and Zinoviev all established in the first years of the 20th century, which I think is a good baseline starting point for all of them. Their lives and activities will constitute a significant part of the history we'll be covering going forward, so obviously we are not done with them by a long shot, especially Trotsky and Stalin. The next episode will be the final Laying the Groundwork episode. We know what Marxism is. We know what Leninism is. We now know who the major players will be at the start of the revolution. All that is left is to set the stage. So we will be touching upon some of the major events in Russian and world history leading up to the Russian Revolution. Some of the events will provide context for 1917 and the period immediately after the October Revolution. Some of them will provide a lens through which we can examine the Soviet Union and understand the motivations of the actors. The usual disclaimer applies that it will necessarily be a cursory glance and lots of details will have to be omitted. But by the end of it, I promise you, we will be strapped in and ready to go. Thank you so much for listening. All translations from the Russian text are provided by me, unless otherwise noted. Any errors or inaccuracies are therefore my own. If you are enjoying this show, and if you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. Any amount helps and is greatly appreciated. This entire project is run only by me in my spare time, and in practicing my anti-capitalist values, I will never run ads. So regular contributions allow me to devote more time, energy, and resources to making the show the best it can be. Please also leave a review and rating on whichever podcast platform you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. If you'd like to get in touch, you can write me at sovietpod@gmail.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. До свидания.